Risky Business.
Risky Business.
Risky Business.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Risky Business. I'm Patrick Gray. We are hosted by Vigabyte Virtual Hosting, but we are brought to you, sponsored by Tenable Network Security. You know these guys. They're the team behind the Nessus Vulnerability Scanner, or, as the guy who first created Nessus would say, the Vulnerability Scanner. Renaud is French. He's very French. I met him at dinner at Auscert in 2005. I don't know if I've told this story before, but I asked him what he did, and that was his response. I make a vulnerability scanner. A vulnerability scanner scans for vulnerabilities. I was like, oh, vulnerability scanner. Okay, got it. Thanks. Anyway, Tenable makes all sorts of groovy enterprise security software these days, including SIM products, and you can check them out at tenablesecurity.com. This week, we're chatting with the chief executive of Australia's Internet Industry Association, Peter Caronius. Peter is a very switched-on guy who I first met as a reporter for ZDNet in Sydney back in 2003, and he really seemed to get security back then, which is quite impressive for like an industry figurehead. So I guess it came as no surprise that Peter, as it turns out, led the charge for a national two-factor authentication scheme many years ago, and it hasn't quite gotten off the ground, but Peter will join the show shortly to discuss the scheme, how it got started, and why it hasn't really got anywhere yet. We're also joined by a special guest in our sponsor segment this week, which is Paul Assadorian, the host of the Paul.com Security Weekly podcast. Paul's day job is as Tenable's evangelist. Now, he won't be evangelizing anything today, hallelujah, but he's popping by to talk about training and certification. In a previous life, Paul did work for SANS as an instructor, and we'll be asking him what he thinks can be taught and what can't, and what role certifications and training plays. But right now, it's time for a check of the news headlines with our regular guest, Adam Metalstorm Boileau. And Adam, the cops have rounded up a bot herder in South Australia, in Adelaide, and apparently this guy's been quite naughty.
Yeah, so according to the reports, he'd owned up, well, about 3,000 machines, it said, trojaned them up with software to steal credit card numbers and was doing actual crime.
Yeah, 3,000 isn't a lot, though.
Well, it doesn't seem like much of a botnet, although actually it said further on the article, additionally, it is suspected, right, so yeah, quality information here. Additionally, it is suspected that this offender had developed capabilities to launch distributed denial-of-service attacks with up to 74,000 computers.
Which meant what? He actually used some of his credit card numbers to buy time on a botnet? I mean, what does that mean?
Yeah, like, the developed capabilities. It's not the same as doing it.
This guy, either he's really stupid or someone dobbed on him. Because really, I mean, how thick do you have to be to get caught for running a botnet?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Doesn't seem particularly clever. And yeah, 3,000 machines, not a real huge botnet there. I mean, owning up 3,000 machines, like, that's... Like, it's what? Like, it's about 1 o'clock in the afternoon at the moment here in New Zealand, and I reckon I could have your 3,000 machines by, what, 1:30?
Yeah. All right, so we're going to be watching for developments there. 20-year-old man has been arrested and charged, and I suspect he will be not having such a fun couple of years.
Yeah, so it said, what, 2 to 10 years imprisonment is the range? Like, I mean, that's pretty serious jail time for what, essentially, like, if he's doing credit card fraud, right? It's just credit card fraud.
Yeah, but it's, you know, other people, you and me say, well, it's just credit card fraud. Other people say, well, you know, it's stealing from people's bank accounts.
Yeah, or cyber terrorism or something. That's
You know, I don't know. Yeah, let's extradite him to Gitmo. That's what we're supposed to do. Do it Gary McKinnon style. And Adam, it turns out those massive denial of service attacks launched against Twitter, Facebook and LiveJournal and Blogger and YouTube were all apparently targeted at one dude.
Yeah, that's pretty funny, eh? Like, taking out the, you know, top 5 social networking properties on the internet just to piss off one guy.
Yeah, it sort of shows you that this whole internet thing might have a few issues.
Yeah, well, mind you, at least, well, Google and Facebook took it, and Twitter and LiveJournal were having a bad day out of it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it showed who was tough and who was not. But, I mean, were you surprised to learn that it was just one guy who was being targeted in this thing?
Well, I guess not. I mean, you know, you've got to wonder, like, what motivation are there to carry out denial-of-service attacks, and, right? I mean, one is you don't like the company, and two is you don't like someone who's hosted on it. So I guess it's a fairly reasonable thing to expect. But, yeah, it's just, you know, it's entertaining for it to be, you know, the entire of Twitter to go down just because, you know, one guy pissed off some other Russian guy with a botnet.
Yeah, it's a little bit lol-tastic. This guy was Georgian, I think, and the nature of his comments, the nature of his blogging and his stuff, you know, his Twitter stuff was pretty political. So I think he's since come out and said it was the KGB what done it. But who knows?
Well, I mean, if it was the KGB, I'd be pretty pleased that all they did was doss, you know, half the sites off the internet. I mean, they could have flipped the polonium up them or something.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, between the polonium, was it polonium 290, which I always thought would be a bloody terrific name for a band. And there's always the, you know, journalists who sort of pop up in various pieces in wheelie bins all across Moscow for writing nasty things about the wrong people. So, yeah, I too would be happy if I had managed to piss off the KGB and the worst they did was DOS risky.biz. That would be quite fine by me.
Well, maybe you could give it a try, see if you can take down Twitter with your risky.biz Twitter account.
Hey, Russia, South Ossetia doesn't belong to you. What are you going to do?
Yeah, Georgia for life.
Yeah, Georgia for life. What are you going to do? DDoS me, huh? Anyway. Now, Adam, we didn't mention this a couple of weeks ago when it first popped up at Vegas, but there's been some guys who've written what sounds like a very similar tool to EvilGrade, which is that software that allows you to basically send bad package updates to various bits of software like Skype or this or that. But it sounds like these guys have worked on a fairly refined version and launched it at DEF CON. Can you tell us a bit more about this?
The tool, as I gather, allows you to attack software upgrades as they happen that don't use any sort of authentication, digital signatures or whatever. And this is something that people have done in a fairly ad hoc manner for a while. And there's been other tools released. I think EvilGrade is the one that comes to mind. But yeah, any sort of software download that isn't authenticated through, you know, PKI, digital signatures, you know, really is going to be vulnerable to man-in-the-middle attacks. Automating this so that it's easy to do is just one more step in carrying out the attack.
Yeah, well, it's funny, hey, I mean, you say that signing helps, but we've also seen with several Linux package management systems that do use, you know, signed packages that you can actually send them old packages and they'll install them as if they're new and reintroduce old vulnerabilities, and then you can exploit the old vulnerabilities on that box.
Yeah, which of course is a great way of doing that, right? It's obviously, it doesn't solve all the problems, that's for sure. But yeah, reintroducing old vulnerable packages, yeah, that is a nice trick.
Yeah, how ironic is it that Microsoft seems to be one of the only OS vendors that's done this right?
Well, it's because Microsoft take this stuff seriously, right? And they've been taking it seriously for, what, 5, 6, 7 years now?
Yeah.
And they're finally seeing, you know, their user base are finally seeing the benefits of that amount of money that they've spent, which is good. I mean, it means that you can actually solve some of these problems eventually, given enough time and resources.
They've been doing it massive since 1986 and, you know, doing it right since about 2004.
Yeah. which is better than Oracle, right?
Well, yeah, Oracle, God. Let's not do that particular rant this week. Let's just try to skip it for once. All right, so moving on to this next story, Adam, and a vulnerability in eBay's, you know, monsters. You can imagine how big their web application would be. A vulnerability in that web application has exposed eBay developer accounts, according to The Register.
Something like eBay, right? There's a whole bunch of users there doing a bunch of things, and you know, an opportunity to break into eBay's developer environment, I imagine, would be very useful if you're trying to steal people's details and credit cards and all that sort of thing, especially given the relationship with PayPal as well. So, yeah, that sounds like they had something compromised, and now they're getting all the developer program members to change their passwords. So it would be interesting to hear exactly what's going on there.
Yeah, it is funny. They did ask for all of their developers to reset their passwords. Now, what's really funny is in the bottom of this story here, it says that over a several-month span in 2007, a hacker who called himself Vladuz was able to penetrate some eBay defenses and gain unauthorized access to parts of its network reserved for employees. Now, what's funny is this guy used to brag about his exploits on the eBay chat board, so he'd be posting about all of these hacks. But he eventually got arrested in Romania, and not so good for him. But there you go. So it looks like perhaps this was, I mean, you know, the fact that that's mentioned in the same story, perhaps that was the, that they've discovered the means by which this guy was actually getting in.
Yeah. Well, hopefully he posts the details on on one of the chat boards.
Yeah.
Prison.
I was just about to say probably the prisonbitch.com board. Probably not the happiest bulletin board on the planet.
I imagine not.
Now, let's all just take a moment to laugh at WordPress, because the last couple of weeks, I think they've released about 600 new versions.
WordPress. one of my colleagues was writing a report the other day, and the customer in question were running WordPress, and they were patched, like, absolutely bleeding edge up to date. and he still gave them, like, you know, severity 5, critical finding. You're running WordPress. This is never going to go well. Just don't.
No, it's not. It's just a big stinking pile of crap, isn't it, really? Like,
yeah, really. WordPress is, you know, in the dictionary, synonym for turd.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, and before we wrap it up, Adam, I believe that you guys have put out a call for papers. Adam, of course, is one of the organisers of the KiwiCon Security Conference in New Zealand. You've put out the CFP for KiwiCon 3, which is going to happen in late November.
Indeed, we have. Yep, we've got the venue and the date sorted out, and that's going to be the 28th, 29th of November in Wellington, same venue as the last two KiwiCons. And, yeah, the call for papers is out. We've got 3 months before the con. So, yeah, everyone who would like to submit something to talk about, that would be great. So, and actually, it's worth mentioning, we haven't announced it yet, but we have some limited funding available for travel for overseas speakers. So if any of you Aukers would like to come over and be an honourable Kiwi for a weekend, then please feel free to submit.
Okay, Adam. Well, mate, thanks for that. And thanks a lot for your time again this week. And, yeah, everybody out there in presentation land, put your presentations together. Go to kiwicon.org and, you know, get them over there.
Yeah, and we're not running WordPress, so, you know, feel free to give it a try against our website. That would be great.
Okay, mate, you have a good one. Thanks again for chatting to us.
See you too, man.
Adam Boileau on the line from New Zealand there with a look at recent news events in the security world. It's time for our feature interview now, and we're chatting with Peter Caronius, the CEO of Australia's Internet Industry Association. The topic is a national two-factor authentication scheme the IIA came up with that hasn't quite gotten off the ground yet. The idea is consumers are given some form of two-factor authentication device, whether that's a RSA token, smart card or whatever. And the idea is that you can use the same two-factor authentication device across multiple websites. You know, you can use it for internet banking, to pay your gas bill, to use with your credit card or whatever. So here's Peter explaining the history of the project.
A few years ago, we realized that internet security wasn't going to get any easier or any safer. One of the big issues that we found was really the inherent lack of security in the traditional username password kind of paradigm by which people could access content online and services online. Increasingly, particularly with the advent of phishing sites, we found that it was just all too easy for unauthorized persons to get access to people's information, or at least the potential was there and was growing. So we put our heads together as an industry and tried to think of a way that we could utilize some of the relatively new technology. It wasn't groundbreaking technology, it's been around for a few years, but to see how we could utilize this so-called two-factor authentication and build it into what we hoped could become a national program for the benefit of content providers on the internet and people providing commercial services.
So this was an initiative of the Australian Internet Industry Association, was it?
Yeah, the Internet Industry Association, in conjunction with some of its members, did initiate this program. We approached the federal government with a proposal for funding to do a pilot program just to establish the feasibility of the idea, at least. And we were successful in that. And as a result of that funding, we were able to do both a technical analysis, and we came up with a blueprint or architecture. And also we did a legal analysis showing where the risks, various risks were within a different model and how those risks could be managed.
What was the timeline for all of this, Peter? Because it actually first kicked off a few years ago, didn't it?
Now, I'd have to go back and check the date, but from memory I'd be saying we were looking at 2003, 2004, somewhere around that time.
Mm. And when did the pilot sort of start to happen?
Well, in fact, what happened was we did the preliminary work for the pilot, and that was the legal work and also the technical blueprint. But of course, part of the issue was finding industry people that were prepared to participate in the pilot. And unfortunately, by the time we got to the end of the program, we found that, and it was a bit of a chicken and egg problem where prospective participants weren't able to commit to things until they saw what was being proposed. And equally, we couldn't propose anything until we'd spoken to prospective players. But at the end, really where it got to was that we did a lot of great work. We now have a very clear understanding of what the issues are going to be, and we think that at some point, sooner or later, a program similar to what we've envisaged will actually emerge. But unfortunately, I think we were just a bit too early to market with this idea, and the feedback that we ultimately got was that our businesses were not yet seeing the kind of commercial losses that would justify them making the investment to participate in a pilot program.
What did the scheme look like? I mean, did it mean that everyone in the country got a token? Did it mean SMS authentication or voice biometric authentication? What was the solution that the IIA and its industry partners came up with after several years and a little bit of funding?
Well, about 12 months it took, Patrick. So essentially what we were looking at was this. We were agnostic as to the type of devices that could be part of a two-factor authentication scheme. In fact, we deliberately architected this in a way that any token, any credible token or device could be used. And essentially, the thinking was this. There are tokens out there already, we said. Some of them were, some might have been smart cards, some might have been the automatic password generated devices that you can put on your key ring. In other cases, there were the SMS authentications that you referred to. And we said, okay, well, let's take all those collectively and say, let's try and build a trust model around that, whereby internet businesses don't themselves necessarily have to get into the business of identifying or verifying the identity of individuals, but rather could rely on the issuing of those tokens that had occurred somewhere else in the plan. So as an example, let's say a bank had already provided you with a token for use with their online banking service. We thought, rather than have that user go out and get additional tokens or devices or systems for logging into other services online, wouldn't it be better if they could use the same token that their bank has given them to log into to eBay or to, you know, their webmail or some other thing like that? And so that really, at a very simple level, was where we were coming from. We were trying to find an efficient way to do it so that we wouldn't be duplicating costs across the industry, but nevertheless could rely on a much higher level of authentication than people were currently using. And also trying to achieve the objective of not having users having to carry around multiple devices. So that essentially was what we were aiming to achieve.
And so what? You know, the people out there in the private sector just didn't see the benefit.
Well, part of the issue was that the banks at the time were not that keen to allow the devices that they were already beginning to issue to be used by other providers. So there was sort of a proprietary mindset that we found difficult to overcome. In addition to that, at the other end, we found that other large content portals were not at the point where they were ready to introduce an API into their standard login systems so that they could change the way in which people logged in. And it's not an inconsiderable investment. We acknowledge that, but nevertheless, we would have hoped that, that there was enough enthusiasm there to at least try the thing and demonstrate the you know, proof of concept. But I mean, you know, this might all sound like it was therefore a huge waste of time, but the truth of the matter is that the thinking that we've done here is still available. No one has proved as wrong, at least in terms of the concept, the idea. I think it still has a lot of merit, even from a straight common sense standpoint. But I think we really would need to see levels of fraud increasing to the point where we reach a tipping point and businesses are prepared to say, okay, enough's enough. We can't internalize these costs anymore. Perhaps their insurers might start pushing back and say, well, what more can we be doing here to minimize the losses? And equally, we will at some point, I fear, reach a situation where users themselves start to lack the degree of confidence and will be looking for solutions like this. So, as I say, we haven't, the planets haven't quite aligned, but certainly the movement of those planets is pushing us towards an alignment at some point in the future, we would think. And at that point, we would be ready to revisit the whole thing and pick up from where we left off.
So how long has it been sitting on the shelf now?
Probably about 2.5-3 years.
Because, I mean, just there has been a lot more discussion these days, particularly in the last couple of years, around particularly around credit card fraud and about the absence of two-factor authentication in credit card transactions. And, you know, I've attended several, you know, crime conferences and things recently where I've heard merchants say words to the effect of, you know, it's very, very large merchants who don't have an online presence saying, well, no, we're not prepared to take on the liability, which is why we're not going forward. Do you think that might be one way to get this scheme up, to get the merchants who are actually quite risk averse to jump on board?
Well, certainly, I think we do need to get some critical mass here. And I guess where we got to was to say, give it some time. You know, if things go the way that we think they are likely to, and I've got to say, Patrick, the degree of sophistication of fraudsters these days is almost defying imagination. We're even seeing exploits occurring on people's routers now, not even on their PCs. They're actually using brute force attacks to infiltrate routers and turn them into zombies, by which identity theft can occur. And it's very, very hard for a user in that circumstance, even if they're doing all the standard sort of security processes that we'd be recommending, to sort of manage the kind of risks that we're looking at. So I think we are going to reach the point, but the critical mass is essential. And I suppose that like many things in life, it's only when the threat is imminent that people really start to pay attention.
Yes, it's not clouds gather on horizon that gets people moving. It's imminent storm threatens village.
It's when the rain starts to fall, exactly, or the lava starts coming down the side of the volcano.
That's right. Now, there have been some changes also in two-factor authentication, and I suppose, you know, one-time password generators like tokens and stuff have been demonstrated to be not entirely effective, but would you imagine that this framework that you've put together is easy to update in terms of the particular types of two-factor authentication techniques that you're using?
Sure. Well, I mean, this was one of the reasons why we didn't want to anoint any particular technology, but rather we were trying to look at building interlocking relationships where you could have, if you like, a trusted third party that sat in between the issuer of the authentication device on the one hand. And, I mean, here's the example. I mean, it may not necessarily go like this, but assume that the user goes to their local Australia Post office, presents 100 points of identification, and is issued with a token, which is then logged against them so that we know that, you know, person X, Patrick Gray, has received this token and is basically in the system. What happens then is that the issuer would notify the trusted third party, which essentially is an amorphous sort of technology platform managed by somebody that sits in between. And then at the other end, we've got the SMEs, the businesses, the content portal, who would be essentially registering with the process so that the user, when they attempt to log on, would be authenticated back through the system to say, you know, is the person carrying this authentication device and exercising this one-time password or whatever the system is.
I mean, yeah, you just want to be able to ask the system, does this guy check out?
Exactly, and it's basically just red light, green light, let him through.
Mm.
So that at a high level is sort of where it was heading. As to your question as to, you know, better devices come along, well, that's the beauty of a scheme that doesn't necessarily say, well, we're only going to use, you know, RSA tokens or whatever it might be. It means that the framework can support innovation and really we want that to occur because we always thought competition between different authenticators was the best way of ensuring ongoing innovation and quality control.
So have you thought about going for more government help with this lot? I mean, they're all about their national broadband network. Is there much that they can do to help you get this off the ground?
Well, again, I think learning from what we've learnt in the past, we've got to come to the view that there is a readiness there and an appetite for this. And I've got to say that as much as the planets are starting to move into alignment, I would still be questioning whether we're at the point where the need for this is self-evident to enough people that we can actually make it happen. That being said, that time is coming, and I really think it's just a judgment call on the part of ourselves and our members as to when we pull this thing back off the shelf and start to try and build further interest in it.
Okay, well, Peter Koronius, thank you very much for your time and for joining us here on Risky Business.
You're welcome, Patrick. Thank you.
The Australian Internet Industry Association's Peter Koronius there discussing the proposed national two-factor authentication scheme. And I know there's some government types out there who listen to this podcast. So, you know, if this is something that you think is good for the digital economy, you go and get in touch with Peter and have a look at what he's put together. But it would be interesting to see if it would be possible to do something of that scale and actually get the implementation right, you know, without someone like Peter Goodman sort of laughing at it. But time will tell. Now it's time for this week's sponsor interview, and each week we let our sponsors come on to the show to have a chat about a security-themed topic, because let's face it, without the sponsors, there would be no podcast. And this week we're chatting with the host of the Paul.com Security Weekly podcast, who is also Tenable Network Security's evangelist. That's Paul Assadorian, and we're talking to him about training. Paul, thanks for joining us, and I believe in a previous life you worked as an instructor for SANS. How did you actually wind up doing that?
I was just getting my start in information security, and I had just been handed I was a systems administrator, and the firewall guy went off on leave, and they were like, Paul, you need to do like firewall and security stuff now. And I was like, well, this is great. The firewall guy never came back, so I'm like, well, I need to kind of get up to speed with all this security stuff. There's all these new tools coming out. I needed to learn TCP/IP. You know, a lot of that stuff was new to me. So I went to my first SANS conference, and I took the, you know, intrusion detection track, and I really, really loved it, right? It drew on my skills as a geek like that nothing else had in the past. So I had to know the network side of things. I had to know the system side of things. I had to learn all these new tools. I had to play with all this really cool hardware, like firewalls and systems and all this stuff, and I was like, this is great. So I got my certification in intrusion detection, and they ended up giving me honors on my first certification with SANS. That kind of got me plugged into the SANS network. So that's kind of how I got my start.
You actually wound up being more or less an instructor, didn't you, with SANS?
Yeah, I did eventually start doing some instructing for the SANS Institute. I authored some courseware for them. I authored a one-day course based on the book that we had written about the WRT-54G hacking. And I've since done some workshops and still maintain a workshop on the WRT-54G hacking, which I haven't really had time for lately, but is still kind of out there and available.
Now, what I find interesting about this whole concept of training is when I was first exposed to this industry, there wasn't really anywhere you could go and learn about this sort of stuff. And there were even a very limited number of technical references that you could actually read that would bring you up to speed on current trends, current topics, current techniques, things like that. So I guess this is a relatively new concept, being able to teach people how to do security. It used to be that black art. And I guess my question to you is, are there some things that are easy to learn and others that are impossible to learn, depending on the student? I mean, how much of this stuff is actually teachable as a traditional discipline?
Well, you really do need a foundation. And you know, where I found the value in SANS is giving me that foundation. So, like, for example, TCP/IP was a huge foundation for everything or just about everything that we do in computer security. And if it's not directly related, we can draw parallels to things like Bluetooth or RFID or other kinds of protocols that we're working with and working to secure. So TCP/IP was one of those foundations. And, you know, I learned a lot of it on my own. And for me, the value was not just to learn from the instructor, which was great. It was a great classroom experience for me as well. It was to be able to kind of work within the classroom environment, then do the certification, force me to study it, and really kind of ingrain it into my brain. And that really helped me build the foundation. So to kind of answer your question, yeah, certification can maybe not teach you the black arts, as you phrase it, but certainly helps provide the foundation so that if I want to go on to do more advanced things, I've got a really solid foundation to build upon.
Now, just say, and this is a big hypothetical, say you were building a team for a brand new bank, and I know that doesn't sort of happen, but imagine that a bank with 30,000 staff just sort of, you know, appeared out of nowhere. And they asked you, they said, hey, Paul, we want you to staff this place with a security team. Would you be able to sit down and say, well, I need 200 guys with this qualification and 50 guys with that qualification? Or is it really about, or is it still coming down to hiring people on a case by case basis and not really relying on their bits of paper to certify a particular skill level?
Yeah, I mean, so for me, if it's my responsibility to keep this bank secure, it requires a one-on-one personal interview with everyone who gets hired. You know, I'm not going to rely on anything that's on paper. I'm not going to rely on any certifications that they have. It requires a one-on-one interview, because really what it boils down to is certification's great, but it's all about what you do with it. Like, I've seen some people that they just go out and get the piece of paper and they're not really passionate about it or involved in it, or, you know, maybe they can just study and take a test really well. To really separate those people out from the people who can do the work, you need to interview them. And I always like to interview people and give them challenges during the interview and see if they can actually do what they say they can do.
Well, this is interesting, isn't it? Because it means that security still is not yet a commodity skill.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. You like to think that if, for example, if you hire an electrician, that electrician has a certification and that they're certified to do electrical work in your home. And I think for the most part, that's true. You know, you may get your electrician here or there who maybe rushes through a job or maybe isn't quite as skilled. But I think for a trade like an electrician, I think it's more true for them to for you to rely on their certification than it is for something like, you know, a softer art like computer security. Because I think of much of what we do is more like an art. And there's so many different areas of specialty, right? Electricity is electricity. But there's a lot of different areas of specialty, maybe even more so than a, you know, a plumber or an electrician, for example. So I do think it's different from a lot of other industries.
Yeah, I guess, but it does have a bit more of a crossover when you start getting into more skilled disciplines, don't you? Like if you wanted to hire a team of architects, you wouldn't just go, well, these guys have got degrees, let's get them. And I guess it would be the same for people like engineers and you know, doctors and things like that.
I wouldn't want like a neurosurgeon like doing my foot surgery necessarily.
Well, you know, let's talk about those subsets within IT security. What are the things that you think are the easier skills to teach? I mean, you can teach someone to be a firewall admin, I'd imagine, pretty easily. Like, you could bring them up to speed, teach them about TCP/IP, because that really is the foundation for, you know, firewalling and understanding firewalling. But can you teach someone exploit development? Can you teach someone how to be a good hacker?
Well, see, now there you've kind of hit on. I think that you can teach someone to be a good firewall admin, like you said. You can teach someone to be a good forensic analyst. You can teach someone to be a good exploit writer, you know, provided they have the technical abilities and chops to absorb that level of information. You can't really teach someone to be a hacker. Like, I truly believe that that's something that is part of your personality. And I've personally, you know, met people amongst my travels, and I've taught a lot of people, and I've run training programs in my various jobs. I've taught for SANS, you know, I do the podcast thing, but, you know, there's just some people that they don't envelop that whole hacker spirit, right? They don't look at things like most hackers do. They don't look at things like, this is something that I can break and how can I manipulate it? It's not in their personality. And those are some of the toughest people to teach. And sometimes I think that those people make very talented network and systems administrators, but maybe not, you know, kind of enveloping what we like to think of as hackers in people that we like to have working for us on security teams.
Yeah, well, I guess what I was going to ask there is when you're teaching a class, I mean, you might have a lot of people who were in the similar position to you, which is they've been sent off by their employers for additional training to be brought up to speed on stuff. And then you might be able to weed out, you know, you might be able to figure out who the hackers are, and say you've got a group of 20, you might go, oh, that guy really knows what he's doing and seems to be sticking to this really, really easily. I mean, do the hackers sort of show through in a classroom environment pretty easily?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you can usually tell in the first few hours of teaching just by the expressions on people's faces and by making eye contact with the room, you know, who's really, like, interested in what you're saying and who's really gonna, you know, kind of latching on to the whole concept of what you're teaching about very, very quickly. I'd say within the first hour or two, you can definitely identify those people. And you know, not everyone is at the same level when they come into your classroom. So one of the rewarding things is maybe taking some of those people that struggled in the beginning to wrap their brain around all of it and getting them to the point where they're kind of understanding and now kind of paying attention to what you're saying at the same intensity as the people who were kind of latched on from the beginning.
Mm-mm. So going back to this, you know, hypothetical bank that we were talking about setting up, you know, we could start it if we get the money, right? That'd be cool. But say this new bank sort of pops up out of nowhere and you wanted to hire that security team. What sort of exam, what sort of technical challenges would you create to weed out the desirables from the undesirables if this was a decision that was up to you?
We were just talking about this recently, and you know, I think it's a great question. What I like to do on interviews, and I've been in a position where I had to hire a few people to work with me on the team, is I like to throw people real-world scenarios. So, and it depends on what they're set out to do, right? So, like, if I'm hiring someone whose primary job is going to be defensive, like defending systems kind of thing, I like to give them a Linux box, maybe with a default install of whatever distribution, you know, it doesn't really matter, and say, you know, hey, here's the root password. I want you to lock this box down. And I want to see how well they do with doing that. Like maybe even give them, you know, these services have to maintain running, but the rest of the box has to be locked down.
Paul, if you really want to fuck with them, just give them a default install of Red Hat 6.2 and say, secure this.
Yeah, but that's a great test. And I'm not saying that they have to secure it, you know, again, I'm not going to come in and do a pen test on it. And if I get in, they're not hired. I'm looking to see, you know, their thought process, their mindset, and how they approach a problem more than anything else. How creative were their defensive solutions? You know, how much they know about actually defending a Linux system? So, you know, that's the kind of things I'm looking for. And those are great real world tests. And you can do that with whatever area you're hiring in, you know, forensics. I can give them a system and say, hey, you know, tell me about this drive. Tell me whatever you can about this drive. And here are the tools and go do it. You know, if they're reverse engineering, I can give them a binary and I can say, tell me about this binary. Tell me what it does. Tell me how it works. Tell me if there's any flaws in it. So whatever their specialty is, when I hire someone, I like to have them demonstrate some of their abilities to me in the interview process. And I encourage people to do the same thing.
All right. But you at the same time, though, you still seem to be a bit of a believer in the education and certification thing.
I do. And, you know, I believe it has its place. I think if you're first getting your start in this field in particular, that training and certification is absolutely key, right? You've got a lot of stuff to learn. I mean, our industry, there are tons of tools to learn. There's tons of different areas within IT security that even if you're not going to be a specialist in them, you still need to know about them, right? If you're a pen tester, you need to know something about forensics because someone might be looking for what you're pen testing and you need to know some evasion techniques, you know, and if you're an IDS guy, you need to know about attacks because you're going to be detecting and defending against the attacks that are coming at you. So I think all people need to be well-rounded. So when you're first getting into the field, training and certification is key. Now, I will separate the two, right? Training is good. If someone's gone out and got the certification, I know as someone who might be interested in hiring this person, they've one, immersed themselves in the material. And that's where the value was for me, was certification was just more of kind of an excuse for me to stay immersed into the material and really ingrain it in my brain. And two, it shows that they can stick with something and achieve something in obtaining the certification. Now, it may not mean they know what they're talking about, but when you're first getting into the field, I think it's immense value to obtain, you know, training and go get the certification. However, as you progress in your IT security career, in my opinion, the value of training and certification diminishes, right? Especially if you identify yourself in other areas. If you're going and speaking at conferences, if you're involved in an open source project, if you're writing papers, whatever, or articles for a magazine, or whatever the case may be, being a podcaster, whatever the case may be, you're now establishing your own brand of yourself, and you may not need certification to further validate your skills or your own personal brand.
I think if you've developed a zero-day exploit in the latest version of SSH, that's probably going to speak a little bit louder than a CISP. Paul Assadorian, thank you very much for taking some time out to chat to us here on Risky Business.
Thanks, Patrick. I know we
That was Tenable Network Security's Paul Assadorian there in this week's sponsor interview, rounding out this week's episode of Risky Business. I'm going to play you a track now by a band called The Basics. These guys are playing about the place at the moment, and they're fantastic, so I highly recommend you go and see their show. They started off as a retro revival group and have morphed into a good old-fashioned rock band. This track is called Better. Go see them. Buy their albums. They're good. Now, you might recognize the vocals from this track too, or the voice at least, because they're performed by Wally DeBacker, who is the voice behind Gautier. He also drums and sings for The Basics. So I hope you enjoy this. Anyway, until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening. But if we weep together, we might feel better.
Beside each other.